correctly with the correct amount.
D20 Radio, your gamers roll. www.d20radio.com.
Roll for Initiative.
Roll for Initiative Podcast, issue number 36. Welcome back, folks. The crew is back together. Jason is back up, maybe hopefully sane this week from his stand for sanity. Who knows, but he's going to report in on that. I am DM Vincent, along with DM Jason, along with DM Nick. Matt quietly in the background, our producer. Jason, why don't you start things off by telling us about the rally?
Okay, yeah, well, probably everybody's heard all about it or seen it. It was massive. The biggest rally that I'd been to before that in D.C. was way back in 91, and it was like 75,000 people, and I thought that was packed. They said there was 215,000 people, so you know how it is when you're at the front of a concert and you can't, you know, you're jammed in and you can't move at all.
Yeah.
Imagine the entire National Mall being that way.
Imagine the Port-a-Johns overflowing.
I didn't go near it. Luckily, we were staying in a hotel right across. If you cut through the Air and Space Museum, it was right across there, so it was really easy to get back to the hotel if that was necessary. But it was completely fun. There was a battle of the bands between Cat Stevens and Ozzy Osbourne, which got broken up and won by the OJs. So that was fun.
It was weird.
It was just a really good time. You know, we went down, saw some museums, hung out around there a lot. And I'll tell you, for anybody who's into steampunk, which I'm not, but I know a lot of people are. If you go to the Museum of American History, the Smithsonian Museum of American History, you'll have a nonstop just overload of steampunk. Because there's this huge area that's all this, you know, all this 19th, early 20th century, you know, just these massive machines and all running on steam power, the beautiful brass and wood everywhere.
Oh, wow.
I could spend 2 days just in the American History Museum. I love that place.
So get a lot of inspiration for steampunk stuff there, huh?
Yeah, it's, you know, history museums, I think, are a good thing for inspiration for anything. If you're playing a spy game, go to the CIA's museum or go to NSA's museum. There's certainly, stuff for more medieval type of things, although I guess not as much in America. Although you could go to the Native American Museum and get a lot of inspiration about, you know, sort of pre-gunpowder days. I think it's a really, you know, it really got me thinking. People should go to museums a lot more when they're, you know, looking for this kind of stuff. Historical influences are great.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir here, buddy, being a history major. So, yeah.
So that was a lot of fun.
Cool.
Neat.
And you also went, where else? You went to panel discussion also, right?
So I got a note from... Tavis, who's one of the guys over at New York Redbox, and we've mentioned it before, New York Redbox is a group of gamers who preserve old school gaming and stuff like that. And there was a panel show last night at the Allegra La Viola Gallery, which is over in kind of Lower East Side, and they had a panel discussion. It was all about Dungeons and Dragons in contemporary art. So it was amazing. It was a two floor exhibition. They had all these different, you know, some artwork that was obviously directly part of D&D or inspired by it, some that was a lot more abstract. Down in the basement, they had done an installation that was basically just a huge gamer's table overflowing with Mountain Dew and chips and everything else.
Nice.
Oh, Matt just found something on your steampunk stuff.
Uh-huh.
He found someone is building a steam-powered computer.
Like a Difference Engine?
Yeah, like the one that Charles Babbage was trying to make.
And Ada Lovelace.
So apparently he's somebody's trying to make a steampunk style computer now.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
that is cool.
Yeah.
So the gallery show, I'll put some pictures up on the site because there was actually a lot of really cool stuff there. Some of the different artists that were talking were Casey Jack Smith, who I think – is he the one that does I Hit It With My Axe? You guys know on the
Escapist. Name sounds familiar. That's from The Escapist, right?
Yeah, that's from The Escapist. So that was one of the artists that was talking.
Hmm. That reminds me. I got to watch Doralius and Associates again.
Yes, you do. Whatever that is, I bet you do.
It's a funny show. Yeah. It's off of The Escapist, just like that. I Hit It With My Axe.
Okay. So they had a whole lot of stuff there, but one of the guys, a couple of the guys were really good, like Zach Smith and Timothy Hutchings. Timothy Hutchings was showing these things, these installations. Basically, he was getting away with running around in the mainstream art world, putting huge gamer installations in and calling them art. And just, it's awesome.
Wow.
He did this one thing where he built these gaming tables for like a tabletop war gaming, you know, for like a Warhammer or whatever type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And but you know, normally you do a table that's maybe at the most like 4 feet by 8 feet or so, because at some point you've got to be able to move the guys across in a reasonable amount of time. And sure. He just took a whole bunch of these to the point where he had things that were like 60 feet long and going off in every possible direction, so there's just no way to actually play it. It was just too
big. Wow. Wow.
And they were amazing looking, too. You know, people would come to these shows and get all excited about that. He had a thing where they went to, I think it was some major bank's headquarters, and talked the bank into letting them take over their boardroom for a LARP.
Wow.
Interesting.
It's amazing.
It was a lot of far out stuff, really fun. And there was
he must have a pretty high charisma.
Yeah. There was one other guy who he was really interesting. He's a Mormon, and he was talking about the Book of Mormon, how the illustrator – I never knew this, not being a Mormon – but the illustrator who – or the artist, I should say, who did all – who was commissioned to do all the paintings is basically this sort of Frank Frazetta type of, you know, big heroic artist. And so all the – everybody who grew up with the Book of Mormon with these paintings in it was already all set for fantasy art.
Wow.
And he was showing how that like led him into his D&D art. That's it was amazing. So much fun.
Yeah, a lot of people, I guess, just don't realize how much of an influence stuff like that can be into even the popular culture. They don't even realize it. Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And I don't know the name of the art critic who showed up because I'm not that knowledgeable about the art world, but Hanai, who went with me, mm-hmm. did know. There's, I wish I could remember his name, but he's basically the largest, the most influential art critic in New York City. And the one of the artists did a character sheet for him. Did this sort of stipple artwork, you know, of his face, and gave him stats and everything. And he heard about it somehow and came down to the show.
Cool.
So, yeah, it was really a completely different kind of night, and I can't stress how much fun it was. Unbelievably fun. The most fun I've ever had in an art gallery.
Do they do that once a year, or?
This is the first time they've done it, and they're probably going to try to do more, because it was a huge hit.
Yeah.
No, it'd be really cool if they could do, if they could take something like that on the road and take it to other art museums and art galleries around the United States, or at least regionally. That
really
would be
should.
Cool. That would be really cool if they could get something like that going, and so everybody else, you know, I mean, that's cool they got it started in New York City. I mean, that's fantastic, but that'd be cool if we could, so they can move that around, or at least have that idea someplace else too. That'd be very cool.
They really should. I'm going to talk to Tavis and push him on that, because there's some video too. Hopefully, we'll be able to post some video at some point from the night, because it was really entertaining, very entertaining.
So Nick, what have you been doing? Your exciting news that you had some great. Where'd you go today, Nick? You've been dying to say.
Well, this is kind of gaming, but it is a game. I got to go to my very first pro football game. I got to see. I got to go to Browns Stadium, watch the Browns and Patriots play today. So that was very, very cool. It was just last minute. But we got to go and had a great time, you know, watched the Browns win. Hooray. I was really impressed. It was such a fun time. But yeah, that was really cool. And I had actually done some other kind of gaming stuff, just preparing in the next couple of weeks for our next game night. That's going to be the week before Thanksgiving. We have a we always do every November for gosh, you know, God knows how long we've been. We do a potluck right around Thanksgiving time. So everybody brings something to eat. And I think during that time, we're going to do Jeff's campaign. And, but before that, while we're eating, we're going to I'm going to have everybody do a character creation session for the new campaign I'm drawing up. So,
any tips or not tips, any hints of what the campaign is going to be about? Or,
It's going to be, it's going to be kind of in the future of what is the current timeline of the campaign world. But it's going to be a lot. I'm not going to say future as in there's going to be like spaceships and lasers and robots. But it's going to be further ahead in the timeline, and there's going to be a lot of changes that they're not going to be prepared for.
Huh.
And not necessarily all of them are going to be very good. So
interesting.
Yeah, there's going to it's going to be a rather different place than what they're used to. And how they get there is going to be very interesting, because they're going to start off in the current timeline.
Cool.
And then somehow they jump into way ahead. So
cool.
And then they're gonna be going, what do we do?
So yeah.
I love those situations. It's gonna be cool. I'm really excited about it. So
okay, cool. Well, I was perusing through the Dragon's Foot forums a couple days ago, and someone tipped me off to a Thundar the Barbarian supplement for Labyrinth Lord. Actually has to do with Mutant Future, and then you have a Thundar the Barbarian Labyrinth Lord supplement. So I've been perusing through that, so you can actually play Thundar and everything and all the
sweet.
Yeah, I know. It's a savageworlds.blogspot.com, I think it's called. It's the producer who does that.
Ooklot, Ariel, ride.
That's right. It was really done very well. So I was like, oh, I may have to take a look at this, and now I might want to actually play it.
That was one of my favorite cartoons.
Yeah.
I mean, you watched that. That was Gamma World.
Yeah.
I mean, no questions about it.
Speaking of Gamma World, the new edition of Gamma World just hit the shelves like the other day, or maybe a week or so ago.
Yeah,
I know Jason's all depressed. It's with the
not that great, huh?
The fourth edition rules.
To be fair, I haven't played it. You know, the fourth edition, or actually, I guess it's like seventh edition Gamma World or whatever.
Yeah, technically.
But basically, all the reports I've heard so far is that they just took 4E Dungeons and Dragons and changed the names on all the stuff.
Yeah.
And then they added in some collectible trading cards that you have to buy in order to play the game.
Right.
Oh, and apparently you can mutate, you roll new mutations every encounter.
Oh, really?
Or maybe even every attack. So somehow you're constantly just mutating all the time.
That's weird.
It doesn't make any sense.
Your character is constantly mutating into different things every encounter. That could be getting a little bit difficult to work out. I mean,
just ridiculous. I mean. It just seems ridiculous, but
okay, we've
who knows?
Fought these mutant dog plant creatures. Oh, look at that. It grew a third arm. Imagine that.
Yeah. Well, the good news is all the other editions still exist, so you can play whichever one you want.
That's good.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I know you recently got the original box set, Jason, right?
Yeah, I actually bought two copies of it because one of them was missing some stuff and the other one was a lousy box. So now I've got two sort of half games and turned them into one good one. But I've been playing with some of the Redbox guys and with Tavis as the DM, and he's a great GM, and it's a lot of fun. First edition Gamma World is a blast.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. And if you're going to get an adventure for it, I recommend, if you could find it, it's called Famine in Fargo. It's a great adventure. It's really fun.
Cool.
You chickens.
Know, one kind of neat thing that he's been doing with the game, because it's set in a post-apocalyptic Earth, he uses Google Earth as part of the mapping for the game.
Oh, that's a good idea.
A lot of people works really doing well. A lot of people have been doing that, which since I've been watching on Twitter and everybody playing the new Yam World that came out of was using Google Maps as well.
That's smart.
Wow. Yeah.
That's very smart.
Yeah, they've been taking like a map of a certain area and just redrawing it and putting their own stuff in it. Interesting to watch it.
Wow. That's cool.
Speaking of interesting, what is our featured podcast of the D20 Radio Network this week, guys?
Oh, yeah. So there's a really good one. There's a new show that is on their 10th episode so far, and they are called Chronicles Pathfinder.
Podcast.
It's just what it sounds like. It's a Chronicles Pathfinder podcast, you know, about Pathfinder. So this episode, they are talking about Council of Thieves, the Sixfold Trial. They have Richard Pett, who's actually the author, as their special guest. They've got a Monster Mash, which is, you know, like our creature feature. They've got Monster Mash, and they have the Abishai. I don't know what that is, but it sounds
cool.
and they also mentioned one other thing that I wanted to make sure we mentioned as well. A lot of gamers have been talking about this. It's a great cause. It's Gamers Without Borders, which is there's a lot of gamers in Cuba who cannot get any RPG materials. They don't have they don't have dice. There was a story of like one guy who took a dead hard drive and pulled it apart so he could, and he marked some numbers on the platter so he could spin it around, and that was his dice.
Wow.
You know, it's hard to get any materials there. There's the embargo from the United States and all that kind of stuff. But there's still gamers that want to play. So Gamers Without Borders is an effort to get RPG materials to people who want them in Cuba.
They should use chits. Use chits. Remember those? Mm-hmm.
Could do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Or we could send them some dice.
Yeah.
So we'll put up a link to Gamers Without Borders. But they mentioned it too. It's a great thing.
You know what? You also remind me of another thing that I remember. I saw when I was in the National Guard and I was deployed in Iraq. It was after I got back, someone was trying to organize a gaming convention there in Baghdad at the MWR at Camp Victory, the Morale, Welfare, and Recreation Center.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually had, I think it was a 1 or 2 day con. It was called Ziggurat Con.
Nice.
And it was for like 2 days. And Wizards of the Coast donated a whole bunch of stuff, and a whole bunch of other people through the USO donated stuff for gamer geeks like me who were, you know, who are deployed overseas who can't get that stuff, or, you know, they have a very limited amount of stuff. You know, maybe they only have like a bag of dice, maybe a couple of books if they're lucky. But it was called Ziggurat Con, and they had, it was like a 1 or 2 day event, and that was another cool thing. Remind me, just like the Gamers Without Borders, very similar. And so anything like that, you know, the support, you know, gamers who are, you know, hard to get stuff overseas, either, you know, in other foreign lands, or support your gamers who are in the armed forces, you know, definitely get involved. So cool. I wholly support stuff like that, and I'll see if there's anything I could do for the Gamers Without Borders.
And for more information about the Pathfinder podcast, just go to justiceradio.net/podcast, and you can download their shows. I think there's a link on their site directly for Gamers Without Borders because they're the ones that started it. Definitely go there and check it out. And if there's nothing else, guys, let's head into Sage Advice.
Sage Advice.
Here we go into Sage Advice. All right, so we have got some voicemails, got some emails, and let's start out with a listener's question, a voicemail from someone we have heard from before.
Yes.
And are always happy to hear from. Let's hear what Lass has to say.
Good old Lass. We love hearing from her, and here we go, guys.
Hey, fellas, this is Lass, and I have a question for the Roll for Initiative podcast. My question is, if you were architects of castles back in a fantasy Middle Ages world such as Dungeons and Dragons, how would you go about making a fortress? For example, what sort of things would you put into it to defend your keep against such nasty threats as dragons, magic, and other things that go bump in the night. Any help would be greatly appreciated. Thanks. Cheers.
You know, what she's talking about, we could do a whole show on.
Yeah, we probably could. Building your own fortress or castle.
Wow.
Well, first of all, it's one of the most fun parts of the Dungeon Master's Guide is stuff about keeps and castles and all that. I mean, I think that got me more interested in being the DM than anything else. You know, because when you're, you know, 13 years old, what's the most fun thing to do to sit around and draw plans for your castle, right?
I think we all did that.
Yeah. I think I might still occasionally do that.
Nice.
So, all right, let's talk about a few of the things that you can put on there. Well, first of all, let's start from the outside. You got to have your moat.
Yeah, a moat or some sort of
some sort of defense around there, whether it's a dry moat or a wet moat. Who says it has to be water in it? If you've got, you know, different things that could potentially go in, I don't know what.
Or if you're lucky enough, depending on the terrain, and I think this goes real world too, having some study in this, it depends on the kind of terrain you're in.
Oh, yeah.
If you're lucky enough that, you know, you're near a body of water, you can maybe divert some of the water and create a moat. Or if you're not, you find the highest ground that's easily the most easily defended.
Mm-hmm. You know, one way up, one way down. Or you build that up. You got to do the one way up, one way down. That's the best way.
Exactly.
Well, a lot of historical castles are actually built in the center of existing bodies of water, especially if you go to, you know, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, etc. You'll have a lot of cases where out in the bay or in a lake or something like that, they've just found an island and said, that's pretty defensible. So there's a good start for you.
Yeah.
Actually, there's a really neat castle that is in... it's in Brittany, up, you know, on the northern coast of France, and it's called Ile Jacobin.
Yeah,
I've wanted to buy this island for years. It actually went
Is that the one where you can only get on and off when depending on the tides?
Yes, that's the one.
That's a cool place.
Went up for sale about 10 years ago, and I was in no position to be buying a castle, so I couldn't have it. But yeah, that's a perfect. Yeah, exactly where I was going with this. You know, when the tide is in, then you're not going to be able to get to it. You can only get there when the tide's out, which is nice.
Yeah.
So moats are a good thing. But what about? And you've got the various are they called balustrades along the castles?
The palisades or.
Well, at any rate.
The battlements. You're talking the battlements? Yeah.
Yeah. I better not use words I don't understand.
What was that? Palisades? Is that New York?
Well, you also have the wall construction, too, what materials that you're going to be using.
And that's going to be different in a D&D world than it is in our history, because we didn't have as many dragons that could breathe fire back in
the Right. And you're going to have some special, like, magical enchantments if you're wealthy enough to strengthen your walls. Heck, you might even have walls like made out of, you know, certain metals.
You'll definitely want to if you are expecting to be under siege by magic users, you'll definitely want to put that metal sheeting all the way across to deal with what are some of the spells that get deflected by metal sheeting?
Lightning bolts.
There's maybe some scrying, I think, that gets stopped that way as well.
Shocking grasp or...
Yeah, you'll definitely want to be doing some things for that.
Fireballs would bounce off it, too, because it wouldn't have anything to really burn.
Probably.
Yeah, the fireballs will probably bounce off of that pretty good, and the stone and all of that.
Yeah.
You're going to want smooth stone, too, so people can't scale it that easily.
Right.
One thing that medieval castle designers of our world did not have to deal with so much was aerial attacks.
Exactly. That's another thing that you would have to keep in mind when you're designing a castle in a fantasy campaign is, you're going to be much more susceptible to aerial attacks, either from, like you're saying, dragons or, you know, riders on hippogriffs or, you know, you get, you know, hawkmen from, you know, from Flash Gordon coming in. So.
I think if I were designing, a castle in the AD&D world, now that I'm thinking about it, there would it makes a lot of sense for a lot of things to be underground. Yeah. And I would definitely have parts of it, you know, even the parts that are within the castle walls, perhaps just covered in earth, even if they're not completely underground, just for defensive purposes.
I would even think that you would go one step further, because if you think about in our real world comparison between fantasy and what we have is there's always an open courtyard and a lot of open areas inside. I would picture a lot of like dome like structures, maybe to protecting from aerial attack. You'd have a lot more defensive measures as far as like I would imagine having a lot more ballistas and crossbows and such to ready to propel an aerial attack as well. So
a lot of slits, it's a lot of slits in the side of the with the portals or what do they call them in portcullises?
Well, you had. Well, you had murder holes that would you could dump flaming oil, right. Boiling water. You also had arrow slits.
Right. You have to have plenty of those. So for ground attacks, you can have your guys flinging arrows through those holes of the ground attack.
Now, everything we're talking about is, you know, defensible. But keep in mind that this thing's got to actually be a working a working castle that's got to have, the serfs or the peasants or whatever your political structure is like in your world. You know, so you've got to have the regular folks coming and going about their business.
Yeah, you're going to have a central keep area. There's no doubt about that. The keep is basically, if you're talking about a castle kind of going from like the early to mid 13th century style onward, you would have your outer defenses of your outer walls, maybe even a secondary wall, and then would have your inner keep area, which is basically the last defense. That would be like, you know, your stand at the Alamo if all other defenses go down.
Yikes.
So you would definitely have a central keep area with that courtyard area where if you had to bring in. Yeah.
Well, I was saying in that case, you probably want to make sure you've got some good escape routes too, that are so you don't end up in a Masada situation.
Well, that's one of the biggest things is one of the misconceptions a lot of people have is many of these castles were laid the siege to, which very rarely any of them were because they were so difficult to attack. Sieges could last weeks, months, or even years. So if you are well stocked, you're well provisioned, and if you have enough water. And your troops and everybody else can keep a relatively high morale. If you could sustain yourself for quite some time, you could almost outlast any siege.
Well, that's another difference between the AD&D world and the real world is that in our real world, if there was a siege, and you know they would do that sort of medieval chemical or a biological warfare, throwing the dead animals and such over the walls. Well, in an AD&D world,
which actually happened, yes.
Yeah, in an AD&D world, you know, fish et la vache.
Yeah,
yes.
but in an AD&D world, you'd probably have some magic users that could fireball whatever comes in, and some clerics that can cure disease.
And you would have something simply as like some guy maybe with a teleport scroll teleporting out to get help from somewhere.
Another thing I think, you know, without making this go too long on one question, but another thing I think would be really good for the designer of a castle is to have some underground races that are there to help you out a bit. If you've got some dwarves that are busy tunneling around underneath, it's a good defense against sappers.
Well, I don't know.
Or gnomes or somebody,
And most castles always had an underground escape route anyway that led somewhere far away from the castle, so any good castle would have to have one of those so the king can escape safely.
Yeah, you would have some sort of escape route. Yeah, for at least the most important people,
right?
Which are your nobles. So
yeah.
One last thing I was just thinking I would probably want to put in since we're talking about magic users and that type of stuff. I think that it would be pretty cool to have some type of a tower that was specific, or multiple ones that were specifically designed for spellcasters. Some ways that they could get more natural advantages from these.
Oh, I could picture something like that.
Something that might even be able to magnify their powers somehow.
Like a glass dome over it or something, and they're hiding it like the Pope.
I don't know.
Something like
the Pope Mobile or something.
The Pope Mobile.
All right. So, yeah. If you want to call in with your voicemail, 570-865-4210, and that's the RFI hotline, right, Nick?
Hotline. Hotline.
570-865-4210. And we'll go on to our email now. Nick, you're going to grab that one.
Yeah, we got an email here from Steve P., and he writes in, hello, Steve. Says, hey, guys, awesome show. Question is, how do you guys feel about, as a DM, fudging the roles behind the DM screen? Should things happen as it happens, or should you call a miss when it's really a killing blow with double damage? What do you think, Vince? Fudging die rolls.
I don't fudge die rolls. I let it roll as it goes.
Yeah, let the die roll as it may. Yes.
Players do it, you do it, you know, just it. And
okay, yeah, Steve P., he writes in and says, hey, guys, awesome show. Question is, how do you guys feel about, as being a DM, fudging the roles behind the DM screen? Should things happen as it happens, or should you call a miss when it's really a killing blow with double damage? So what do you think, Vince?
I let them roll as they go, and where they fall is where they fall. If it happens to be that killing blow, you know, that's what happens. That's it. You can't fudge numbers because of those things. I mean, you can't feel sorry for a player. I mean, that's what happens. He knows the breaks.
Yeah, yeah. I have to admit, in the past, I have fudged die rolls once in a while. Unfortunately, it was in my favor. But I've gotten better with that. And now what I do, at least in the past few years, is all my die rolls as a DM, they're actually in front of everybody. I don't go behind the screen and make die rolls anymore. I do them all in front of my players. The only thing I keep behind my screen is, you know, my player note, you know, my notes for the adventure and stuff like that, so they don't have to see it. So, but die rolls, they're all out in front. How do I feel about otherwise? I've actually was in a situation a few years ago where I know,
right,
that,
yeah,
that the DM, I was the player, I had a really good feeling that the DM was fudging die rolls.
For your advantage or for his advantage?
Oh, for the DM's advantage. Just for the simple fact that they did, like, I don't know, more than 10 critical hits on our characters in one gaming session.
Oh, well, yeah.
What did that do to the game?
Well,
did it sort of dispirit everybody?
I remember it was at a convention. So, unfortunately, stuff like that can happen at conventions because a lot of times you don't even see these people anymore. So they feel like they could get away with it. And two, I just kind of like went along with it and just kind of went on. I was just thinking now that this is impossible. You know, 10 critical hits on us. I mean, you know, get real. Right. But hey, that was okay. We still came out all right. I do remember all in all, we came out okay. But when stuff like that, when it's blatant, like
that's not really
with us,
getting away with anything. I mean, he didn't get away with anything. He made the game less fun for everybody. That's hardly getting away with it. I mean, he it sounds to me like that DM, you know, basically made himself out to be a DM that you wouldn't want to play with again, and that sort of defeats the whole purpose.
True. You let the dice roll where they go, but not just every other roll. Oh, look at that, a critical. Oh, look at that, a critical. But
now that being said, I fudge.
You do?
Absolutely, I fudge. Okay. And I fudge when I think that there's something that is going way too well or way too badly for either the monsters or the players, when it's something that's mm-hmm. just going to break the game.
Okay.
And I want to actually go to Gary Gygax's book, Role Playing Mastery, for a quick quote.
Oh, you got that.
About
okay.
this. Cool. There are times when the GM will bend or break the rules of the game system in order to allow his players to maintain their characters. Just as he sometimes metes out punishment for infractions, the GM at other times intervenes benevolently, spreading his aegis over the PCs to save them from probabilities gone awry. To put it bluntly, when play it as a low ebb, or it is quite likely the players or characters are about to suffer undue loss or extinction, the GM cheats and decrees otherwise. Opponents miss their blows, PCs manage to strike their foes, and various sorts of miracles occur. This is wrong only when it's done too liberally or when it is unwarranted.
Hmm.
If the PC party is in danger of extermination through no direct fault of their own, and because a string of unlikely occurrences have all somehow come to pass, then this is the time for the GM to step in and set things back on the right track, or at least keep them from getting any worse. So, I think that it's fair.
Everybody has their own way, I know, but... I mean, when I roll critical hits, I will lift the shield up and show every player without touching the dice. So it's not
for sure.
It's not like Nick's DM there going, critical, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I fudge, but it is not a part of the regular gameplay. It's at those exact kind of moments that are described in the book. It's the times when, you know, if you didn't let the guy hit at this point, it would just destroy everything you guys have been working up to for the last three game sessions, or, you know, vice versa. They've done everything right. They've made these heroic feats. It's the last moment and you roll a one and you're just like, that can't happen. It just, everybody would go home and having a lousy night. So you say, that's not what I rolled. I rolled a 10 or whatever.
So that's what you sit down before you play the whole entire campaign and say, everybody, listen, this is how we're going to do it. Wherever the dice roll, they roll. There's not going to be any favoritism. And most people will go for that as long as you're upfront with them about that whole situation.
I don't know. Well, if you listen to any of the actual play podcast, once the rest of mine are up, I know there's some up right now.
Uh-huh.
I think that for one thing, you'll definitely never know when I've just fudged a roll because...
Oh, I was able to tell a couple times when you did that.
What's that?
I was able to pull off a couple times when you fudged some numbers, Jason. I was listening to those actual plays.
I'd like to know if you were right. I'd be interesting to know if you were right.
There
about
was
those.
One roll you were just like, but, and you're like, okay, that was a miss. And I was like, yeah, he's totally lied.
maybe.
I have to agree with the one section where it gets up to where Gary says in that section about basically when you're too liberal with it, basically if you're a habitual fudger on the dice and it's always too...
Oh yeah, that's no fun.
Yeah, that I can understand maybe here and there, you know, where like if it keeps the campaign going and people are happy, you know, I can understand that. You know, I've done that. I mean, I think we all have as DMs, but where you see DMs like where I experience where they are actually fudging the die rolls to their advantage always and they're constantly, I'm sorry, lack of better term, screwing the players over.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, that's not cool.
No. You know, that's the same as a player cheating. It doesn't.
Exactly.
This is not a competitive game. You're not trying to win. So it doesn't make any sense to cheat. Why would you cheat in a game that doesn't have a winner or a loser?
That was when I told you guys with my friend that had the three-sided 20 die, the dice with the three 20s on it.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the fun of that? I mean,
yeah, what's the point?
But if I've got a group of players who are – they're starting out. It's their first level. A couple of them are new to role-playing. You know, there's a saying that somebody told me at a con once, and when he was demoing a game that I'd never played before, he said, always let the Wookiee win.
Yeah.
Nice.
The point was, you know, I think he was showing me some cool, like, skirmish game and how to play it. And, you know, the point was, if you're trying a game for the first time and it's frustrating and you die and nothing good happens, you're not coming back.
Yeah, that's true.
By that same token, if you're obviously being coddled and cheated for and given, you know, easy goes, you're not going to come back for that either. So right. Keep it fair.
Or if you're constantly feel like that the person who's the referee, GM, or DM is continually, you know, beating down on you, that's not fun either. So
not fun at all. So keep it fair. You know, if something crazy happens that you just as a DM think that's going to ruin the game, you're the DM. It didn't happen. But it doesn't mean you should sit around doing that as a matter of course. And you should never try to cheat to be, you know, to kill a player.
Right.
That's just juvenile.
No, that really is.
Oh, well, you know what? I think that kind of wraps it up on that one. We'll see what everybody else thinks, though. So come over to RFI forums and let us know what you think about fudging the die rolls and how often you should do it, or if all. So, or email us at yes. RFIpodcast.com. You can email us, all three of us, at our emails. And
RFI, that's right. I guess, so, that's Nick at RFI. Wait, is it DM Nick?
DM Nick at RFIpodcast.com. You can email me, or you can email Vince DM. Or Jason.
DM Vince, right?
Or yeah, DM Jason.
I haven't
it's just Jason.
Oh, it's just Jason. Jason at RFIpodcast.com.
Or so, do a general email to RFIstaff@gmail.com for show notes or show questions.
That'll work, course, too.
And, of course, we do always have the voicemail phone number, which you can call 57-086-54-210.
What?
Huh?
Jason no, just it's... making up a number there randomly. I mean,
it's actually
57-086-54-210.
Oh my God, you're right. It is. He's just saying it weirdly.
I hate you, Jason. Nutso.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and we'll move on to table manners then.
Typical. Of all the evil creatures in the world, I'd like to find one with table manners.
And what, are you kidding me? I spent years cultivating the worst table manners on the planet.
Table manners.
All right. Table manners this week. And this is kind of a cool segue into that from our last discussion here on, you know, fudging die rolls, is house rules.
Yay.
Yeah. Special house rules for your game. And so we'll talk about some of the house rules that maybe some of us have and some of our listeners have, the pros and cons of using house rules, and we'll just kind of go from there. So let's start with Vince here. Vince, do you have any particular house rules that you, when you start off a campaign, mm-hmm. you say, okay, guys, this is the campaign, and this is the rules I'm going to use, and these are some of the ones I made up that we're going to use. So
yeah, I wrote down a whole page here pretty much of house rules that I use, that I normally use. I'm not using mm-hmm. them in really in my actual play podcast, but I have these written down for when I play in my regular group. But I do max hit points at first level.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of us do that.
Some people do that. Some people don't. Yeah. I think, Jason, you weren't doing that with your game, right?
Sort of. I mean, I do not do max hit points, but what I do is you roll, but it only it has to be over half the die.
Okay.
You know, okay. So anything under 50% of the possible, I say re-roll again. Until you get that. Yeah, because nobody. Cool. Yeah, a player with one or two hit points. I mean, that's
poor magic user D4.
When rolling up stats, you can do 4d6, drop the lowest one.
Okay. Okay.
Any stat that you get that's a 6 or below, you can re-roll. One time only. If you get lower, too bad. You have to stick with that.
That's cool.
So if the party's a smaller party and I want a higher power, like a high-powered game, I'll have them start mm-hmm. with a 10 base and roll a D8.
Ah, interesting.
So that way you can have a minimum of 11. That's only if you say, like, there's two people in the party and I really want to play and they really want to play. When rolling an attack roll, a 1 is automatically a failure or a fumble. You look on a chart. A 20 is automatically a critical or a success, mm-hmm. and then you would roll a 20 again. Like I explained before, if you get an 18 to 20, it's 2.5 damage. You can roll again if you get that mark. If you get a 20, you do 3 times the damage, and then you roll again. If you do another 18 to 20, it's 3.5, and if you do again with a 20, which is kind of impossible, but I've seen it happen once.
Sure,
it's insta kill.
Okay, now I got a question on that.
Yeah.
Crits and fumbles in your game, that goes both ways, right?
Yeah, monsters and players, yeah.
Okay. A lot of people forget that when you introduce... I'm sorry, kind of just a little side note. A lot of people, when they play, forget when you introduce crits and fumbles into your campaign world.
Mm-hmm.
They forget that, you know what, folks? This goes both ways. Monsters can do it, too. So.
Oh, yeah. If you listen to any of my actual plays, you'll hear tons of the monsters falling over, falling down traps, whatever. as far as clerics can swap out any spell in their that they've prayed for a heal spell in the, if they need to do it in the nick of moments. Like if somebody's dying and they can swap it out. I don't know if that's an actual rule. I think that was later on. Maybe that was incorporated as a rule.
I know it showed up in one of the later editions because somebody was talking about it on the forums, but I can't remember which. But yeah, eventually that did become a rule.
Right. Yeah. I like that rule because I think it's you're a cleric. You should be able to, you know, in your party's in a dire need, be able to pull out that heal spell.
Okay.
Cool. Heal spells also have a 10-foot range in my games too. I know it's just a touch spell, but I feel that
ranged healing.
Yeah, you should have a 10-foot range on it at least. Initiative. I use the Jason system of a D6. Lowest goes first using his segments. Let's see. Called shots would be -4 for say like an eye or like an exact hand, and then -2 for say like. Like a larger limb, like a leg or an arm. Let's see here. If you play Chaotic Neutral, which I can't stand in my games, but people tend to play it anyway, I ask that you pick a tendency towards good or evil because I'm tired of people playing Chaotic Neutral and just doing everything evil in the world going, but I'm Chaotic Neutral.
Yes.
And I'm sure you've encountered that quite a bit, Jason.
The most abused alignment to play.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if they're playing Chaotic Neutral and they're acting evil, then I just say your alignment has changed to Chaotic Evil.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the attendant loss of level and things that go with it.
Exactly. But then, you know, I'd rather not just get into an argument with the player. I'll just say pick your tendency. That way they can, you know, pact however That's they good. Want. Wish spells have to be written on a paper. And after written on paper, and the player may take 5 to 10 minute break from the game to write this down, and they may include whomever in the situation can join them. Say if another party member's there to help them, but if they're by themselves, they have to go by themselves and write it down.
That's fair. That's
and
fair.
That's pretty much where I cut it off because I didn't want to spend too much time on just my notes because I can go on forever.
Actually, well, a lot of those I like. A lot of those house rules I think are pretty cool. They are. I could see the logic behind them, and yet I don't think they overbalance it at all. So
no, they're just
I probably enough. Wouldn't do some of the cleric things because I have a little bit different approach with healing in my game. But I see the point behind a lot of those. Yeah,
yeah, and that whole blunt weapon thing I just don't get. But
oh, let's not get into that. And my another rule is clerics must.
Well, that's
use
one of my weapons. House rules.
There you go. So let's hear yours.
Yeah, let's hear yours.
Okay. Well, here's a funny thing. I've been playing a lot of Hackmaster the past few years, and a lot of it is kind of like house rules in it, too.
Right.
I mean, so I don't know. I don't really have a whole lot of house rules if I was going to do AD&D again, which I'm hoping to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if I'm going to incorporate some house rules in AD&D, I would definitely have crits and fumbles.
Right.
Clerics, yes, might have a weapon of choice depending on their god. What their god uses. I would have that. As far as initiative, I'd hate to say it, but I really like the D10 initiative. I've been using it for so long. I like D10 initiative and going
what,
from there.
What do you mean?
D10. Well,
you're using D10 like, for segments?
Yeah.
Yeah, for initiative.
Let me just ask you on that for a moment. I'm assuming that you're saying D10, whatever you roll, that's the segment your action begins on?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, D10 with a modification from your dex, if applicable.
Right, yeah.
Oh, I really got to talk to you about that one. But
That's the second edition system, isn't it? I believe so.
I don't know. I just remember that,
D10 was like, the D10 initiative was like in second edition.
Yeah.
Well, the dex, I mean, that's one of the things that was really specifically pointed out in the DMG. You know, the dex is not going to affect your initiative. So I just said, you know what, that's fine. I get why that is, and I left it as it was. But the thing about the D10 is what I wanted to ask. So I'm assuming you're saying if somebody rolls a 3, then that their actions are calculated from the third segment, right?
Right.
Yeah, they go on segment 3, yeah.
So what do you do in the case of somebody rolling a 9 or a 10, especially if they're doing something where their actions are going to take them over into the next round? How do you handle it?
Then they go into their action will go into the next round. Like if they're pulling spell components, for example.
Right. I guess what I'm thinking about is that you could eventually get into a situation where you got a lot of bookkeeping going on because somebody's, keeps rolling later and later segments, and they're doing long actions. Well,
I trust my players enough that they could keep track of that themselves.
Okay.
I don't necessarily keep track of that. I just call out the numbers for each segment. And I'll ask them if anybody has, like, if anybody's doing something that's taking longer than an initial combat round, then I'll say, okay, well, then you're going to go, what's your initiative? They'll tell me, like, well, I rolled an 8, but it's going to cost me 3 actions. So, yeah, you're going to go on initiative 1, on segment 1 on the next following round then.
Oh, so you've got you're rolling individual initiative too.
Yeah,
yeah.
So there's another house rule. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the initiative is based off of what everybody rolls as far as their segment, including the monster too. Mm. So it's kind of mixed together there. There's not one separate players go, one separate monster goes. It's all going happening at the same time. So yeah,
Now I'm confused. Hold on a second.
Yeah.
Everybody's rolling their own initiative, right?
Yes. Yes.
So they're okay. I'm just going to let it go.
Yeah. That initiative number is what segment they go on.
Okay, yeah. Fine. I mean, you could do that normally. The only reason it wasn't originally set up that way in the book is just because it would have been a lot of bookkeeping. But if you figured out a way to do it smoothly, then you're great.
Yeah. I have a little tracker on the top of my screen there. That tracks it from segment, you know, 0 to 10.
Well, I have when I go to a local con, MEPACON, which is coming up next weekend, actually here in Pennsylvania, there's a guy that runs First Edition, and he does D10 segments also, like Nick does, and he says, well, that's how Gary wanted it to be originally, but he wasn't allowed to put that in there. But another time, another story. But anyway,
it's a good way to do it. I mean, I actually have my little chart that I was keeping for a while, which was, instead of having sliders, I was using a whiteboard. Yeah. Now I've just kind of gotten to the point where I keep it in my head. But I asked because when I do a D6 segment of action, it's because I don't want people rolling onto the 10th segment. It just makes it difficult for me. So if somebody's really high, like the party rolled a 6, and somebody's doing something that takes a lot of segments of action, I'll usually just say, okay, this is just happening at the end.
Right.
And the only exception I'll make to that is if you're casting a spell which takes multiple rounds, because that you've kind of already got an easy way of dealing with, which is saying, okay, this is going to take you X number of rounds. But I don't get into, you know, how many segments have you gone over into the next one, because my head is split.
And I got to figure to, like, when you got your fighters, when they go high enough in levels, they go, you know, the 3 for 2 for attacks or 2 for 1 attacks. Yeah, that's easily split up, like. They go 3 for 2 attacks when it's their 2 attack round. You have them roll their initiative, and that's numbers, their segment they go on, and 5 segment later it is their segment attack. So say if the guy rolled, you know, a 1, then he'll go on segment, 5 or 6, you know. So, and it's pretty easy. And I trust my players that they'll track that themselves too, like when their attack is going. I just count out the segments, and when I'll say, okay, it's segment 1, whatever happens there, okay, nothing. 2, okay, you got 3 people going on 2, then I just go, okay, the highest dex goes first.
Sure.
And it works well. It sounds a little weird, but I think I hate to use this term, a little more realistic, because it's, you know, combat is kind of chaotic and everything's happening at the same time. But that's one rule I use. Like I said, crits and fumbles is something I use. One thing I'm considering, like when I do another AD&D campaign, is if anybody wants to play the bard, I'm thinking of using a bard out of the Dragon Magazine articles instead of the one out of the book.
Well, actually, one of the people in the forums, Ben, from Boise, had same thing. He said he uses a version of the bard from Dragon's Foot that allows play from first level.
Right. Yeah, yeah. There was one out of, I think it was in Best of Dragon Volume 3. There was a version of the bard I kind of liked. The monk too. I think I would use the same one. There's a version of the monk that one of the issues of Dragon Magazine.
I'm just looking here. Bodine, another one of the forum members, Bodine, says he also uses the D10 for initiative with 6 second rounds.
Yeah.
Oh, 6 second rounds. He says he actually has 6 second rounds. So that's actually a very different house rule. Okay.
Yeah, that's way different. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think if there is anything else I would use as far as any other house rules. I guess specifically if I want to like get away from everybody who, or a few people playing evil characters, I would state that at the beginning of the campaign, like maybe no evil characters, or if you're going to play something evil, only lawful evil.
Yeah.
Because that's about the only alignment I could see that works with any other mixture of alignments is that's evil, is lawful evil with any others that are non. But that's just me.
Well, I think I'm just looking at a couple other things people on the boards have said. One that came up was one that I've heard a few times, which is allowing magic users an intelligence bonus for spells, like the cleric gets a wisdom bonus.
Yeah, I've considered that one, and I'm not sure about that, but I'm inclined to maybe include that one as well. I can't see it hurting at all. In fact, if anything, it makes the magic user at lower levels a little bit easier to use, and it kind of makes sense in a way.
Yeah, I got to admit, I feel the same sort of way for a magic user. My approach, at least in this campaign that's going on, is I had a ring of wizardry amongst the magic. I mean, a weak one, but something that would give just a little extra oomph to the low-level magic user.
Sure. I'm also toying with the idea of getting rid of level limits for demi-human characters.
Wow. So, yeah, that's a whole nother topic.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people do that, not so much as a house rule as a just, I'm just not doing this one.
Yeah, and most of the players don't even get that high enough level to even make a difference anyway.
Well, that's the difference. I think we should distinguish between a house rule, which is something you've actually kind of come up with and you do because you do it your own way, versus just something you choose to ignore from the rule book, I'm sure we've mentioned it before. Everybody's got something they ignore.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course. No one goes.
Yeah. Like, was it the weapon to armor modifiers?
Yeah. Although they're kind of fun, if you can get them working, it's kind of a nice little thing to have in there.
That's one of those things that's I don't think I ever used them when I first played AD&D, but that was kind of a rule that people ignored. But
it's easily misinterpreted.
Yes. I can't really think of any other house rules off the top of my head that, jumped to my mind that I would actually use. What about you, Jason? Yeah. What are some of your house rules?
Well, as you guys have already mentioned on the combat, I do have my own sort of combat approach. It's not really two house rules. It's just taking a little bit of that segment of action type of stuff. And I find that it makes it really fun. I do my best to keep the combat, feeling like it's all happening at once, so that I think works out pretty well. Mm-hmm. As far as one thing that it's not necessarily a house rule, a lot of the stuff that I would consider house rules is more like I've gone through and picked it up from other people and from Dragons, but skill checks. So
yeah,
I've chosen to do I never liked the idea of a straight up skill check, roll a d20 against your dexterity or whatever. So what I use is an idea that was not my own, but I think is a really good one. I will figure out how difficult something would be against a certain skill and have them roll a number of d6s, based on the difficulty. So if somebody wants to do something that requires, I suppose dexterity is one of the most common ones you'd think of. If they're trying to, let's say, do a sort of a 70s cop roll off of a wall or something, I'd look at this, and if I think that it's really easy to do, I'll say, okay, roll 3d6 and come in lower than your dexterity. If I think it's really difficult, it could be 4, 5, or even 6d6 that they have to roll and come lower than.
Star Wars d6 used to do that. It sounds very similar to how the West End Games Star Wars system was when they used
it. Works
D6s.
Really well. I mean, when it's possible, if I know, for example, that the game we're about to play is going to have a lot of swimming, I'll try to look up the swimming rules beforehand. Or if I know that there's going to be jumping over chasms, I'll go and find my favorite jumping rules. And there's a lot of different jumping rules. I don't think there's any in the original DMG, but obviously you've got some in the later books. Yeah. And at least two or three different versions in Dragon magazines. Yeah. So I'll try to pick those things out ahead of time. But if a surprising situation comes up I wasn't prepared for, that D6, multiple D6 skill check seems to work pretty well.
Now that you mention it, I remember, like, in the DMG, there's that, was it that secondary skills section, or...
I love the secondary skills class.
Yeah, I've actually, that would one thing I would consider using too, like, because you could be, like, either a sailor or, I guess, a blacksmith or something like armor, yeah.
It would be kind of fun.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it would be kind of fun to come up with a system of, you know, putting a few attributes to those secondary skills. Mm-hmm. Something kind of along the lines of Top Secret.
Yeah.
Or Cthulhu, you know.
Ooh, yeah.
I have to say, I mean, I don't do this right now, but as we're saying this, I love the skill charts from Cthulhu and from Top Secret. And I know there's probably a lot. I think Traveler is similar, has similar ones.
Yeah.
I'd like to bring those into AD&D. I think that could be a lot of fun.
Are you talking about the chart where it's like the active against the passive trait, and then you make a roll, I think it is? There's a chart that.
You're talking about in Cthulhu?
Yeah.
I think I am. I'm more familiar right off the top of my head with Top Secret, which is a pretty straightforward percentile. So you've got all these different things that you could be skilled at, and you have a percentile roll to see how skilled you are.
That's
kind of fun. The thing is that in Top Secret, these skills are not generic. They're very specific, and they're most closely aligned to the secondary skills chart in the DMG. So I'd kind of like to do that, something like that.
Cool.
The only other things so I have a little bit of house rule when it comes to psionics. And this is new because obviously I've just started playing psionics in there, but a couple of little house rules in there that it can be interrupted. Your psionics can be interrupted by any kind of physical, anything that breaks your concentration.
Sure. Okay.
I figured out so far that psionics work best to just resolve independently of the rest of the combat because it happens too fast and gets too confusing otherwise. And there's a couple of house rules in terms of what it takes to get them. I think if you're going to play with psionics, it shouldn't be that impossible to get them because otherwise it does have a chance to unbalance the game. So the way I do it is I actually have have them roll a series of rolls of increasing difficulty. So I can't remember off the top of my head exactly how many they get, but it's something along the lines of the first time you have to roll over a 50, and if you do that, you get a reroll. The next time it's harder to get a reroll, and you get, you know, it goes up to 60, 70, 80. So they can keep getting a chance to get a reroll until they get the number that they need. It's
cool.
It's still really hard to get it. Nobody's got
it.
But, you know, it gives them a chance.
Okay.
That's
cool.
Some psionic things. A couple of other little things. The time, the way I handle time, this isn't so much a house rule, it's just sort of a little DM's trick that I find to be really useful. I have a whole lot of paper printed out with little hash marks on it. It's divided into – each line is an hour. It's divided into not each line is an hour. Each line is a turn, is a 10-minute turn, and so every six lines is an hour. And I can just – as I'm going, I can just sit there and make little marks along the paper. So I can kind of keep track of how time is passing.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
I find it's really important because you always get in a situation where your players are saying, so is the sun still up? Is it nighttime yet?
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, God, I don't know. Is it nighttime yet? So at least this way, I'm not, you know, being super OCD about marking every time everything happens. But, you know, it's a helpful tool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I keep an eye on it. And then the last thing is just about healing. This is not a house rule. It's more something that I didn't think was defined very well in the DMG. And I went and asked around, you know, with everybody, what do you guys do about somebody who goes under zero hit points and needs to be stabilized?
Right.
So the way that I now do it is if a player is knocked below zero, you know, obviously more than negative 10, but below zero.
Right.
Anybody can administer first aid to stop them from slipping further towards death. It was a, you know, if it was something that you could do first aid for, like a cut. I mean, if the person has just been, I don't know, vaporized or something, if it's something that that common sense would tell you that injury can't be treated.
Being vaporized, kind of,
yeah.
I gather his ashes. Yeah.
Any wounds that you could realistically bind, then I say, okay, you can bind them, you can stop the loss.
Stabilize them.
Exactly. And that player is still unconscious, but they're going to heal at the normal rate of one hit point per day. So even if you can't do anything else to them, the player who's at negative four hit points, you can bind them up and put them in bed for 4 days. And they'll be
sure. Basically like they're in a coma or something.
Yeah. So that's it for me, really. I'm not too much into house rules.
I got a question for everybody here. And this is what I was kind of thinking when we were talking about this segment. And I'll start this off with my answer is, you know, what do you think was the first house rule that was probably made up that was used extensively? And I think probably the first house rule was probably for crits and fumbles. That's the one I can remember, because I remember going to I can't remember what con. This was back in 1980, blah, blah, blah. And it was probably Omicron, Vince.
Omicron?
And Jason. Jason. Yeah. It was probably Omicron back in the early, mid-80s in Omaha, Nebraska. And I remember the local game. There was a gaming group. And they made a booklet. It was maybe a buck or two. And they had all these different charts that they printed up for critical hits and fumbles. And I remember buying that. And I was like, oh, this is really cool. I can use this in my game. I remember reading through them like, wow, some of these are pretty intense.
Yeah, so fun. I think you're probably right.
Critical hits and fumbles might have been the first.
There's a good article in Dragon Magazine called Good Hits and Bad Misses that has a great list of potential crits and fumbles. The only reason I'm not using it right now in the games that I'm running is that I haven't gotten a system that I feel comfortable with for determining when a crit happens. I think Vince, your approach is really good, because you know a 20 by itself should never be a crit. It's 5% chance, but you're rolling beyond that to give it to make it work out. And I think something like that's the way to go.
You had some interesting system. I was listening to your actual play podcast. It was something to do with you had some chart you were going to use, but then you stopped using it right in the middle because you weren't too comfortable with it.
I think that's the one.
Was that the one? Oh, okay.
Yeah, because we started using it, and I was like, this isn't working out right. I'm gonna just table it for now until we can
I was interested in hearing what it was about, and then you were starting to explain it, and you were just like, you know what? I'm just tabling this. I'm like, oh.
Yeah, well, it'll make its way back, but I have to learn my limits. You know, I have to learn that there's some things I'm not ready to do, and there's only so many hours in the day for me to plan for this stuff. And I'd rather, as far as the game goes, I'd rather spend that time, you know, prepping the good story than making sure I have the crits ready at that point.
Yeah, story always trumps rules, so.
It should, yeah. I mean, when you were saying, Nick, you know, what was the first house rule? I'm like, everything was the first house rule. You know, the entire game was house ruled originally.
So. Depends on who you're talking about. If it was Gary himself, probably the first house rule was everything that he didn't get included into the book.
So. Well, I'm talking like just beyond that. You know, after everything was published, as far as like once you get into first edition AD&D, what do you think was like the first house rule that was a lot of people used? Widely,
ditching the level limits. You're probably right. I think crits was probably one of the first.
Yeah.
One good thing you guys just brought up from the forums. I think it was somebody was talking about rerolling the character's hit dice every level.
That was on our forums. Yes.
Yeah, and so I don't know. I'm hoping one of our listeners knows and can tell us. I thought that. Maybe the white box rules or something that was originally how it, maybe it was all the way back to chainmail. No, because chainmail didn't have that. No, I have no idea. But the point is, I have no idea, but I thought one of the earlier rule systems that's how it worked.
No, that was a house rule as far as I know. And I know the Moldvay and Mentor rules pretty well, and they don't do that in those.
If anybody has any
idea what I'm talking about, because I clearly do not, so if anybody does know what I'm talking about, please let us know.
Yeah, I know I house rule, when you mentioned like for hit points, I house rule max hit points plus a con bonus at first level. I do that, but Yeah, that's a new one. I don't even know if in the earlier versions, like Beyond the Moldvay version, if that was a rule like you're talking about.
I don't think it was. Next, it wasn't Dr. Next, Holmes edition either, so I don't know what one that would have been.
Yeah.
Well, next week I'll be over playing with some of the New York Red Box guys. We'll be playing White Box D&D, so I'll find out. Somebody's got the white box, and we're going to be playing it, so I'll let you know how it goes, because I've never played those rules.
You could play a fighting man.
I will be fighting man.
Do you have any more house rules, Jason, or are you complete?
No, I think that's. I think we've beat this one to death.
All right. So let's head over actually into Creature Feature Theater.
Creature Feature Theater.
This week on the Creature Feature Theater, we have an guest DM. It's our producer, Matt. And Matt, you want to say hello?
Hello, everyone. Yeah, I'm glad to be on again. Thanks for actually having me back on air. So I guess it wasn't too terrible last week. So.
Yeah, let's just hand you the keys and go for it, man.
Okay, so everyone has the characters that I sent out earlier?
Yes.
Somewhere. Where'd they go?
I forgot my dice.
Well, just trust me with my rolls. I won't fudge anything. I'll roll for you.
Yeah, I gotta go back to my house. I forgot my character sheet.
My dog ate my character sheet.
All right, here's the characters. Ready to go.
Yes. Yep. Okay, good.
Who wants to start and tell us who's playing what?
Since you spoke up first, why don't you?
Okay, good. I am playing Heinrich Jägermeister, Dwarven Fighter.
Yar!
That's right. And fifth level, he's got pretty good stats, got a 16 strength, got obviously the obligatory battle axe for being a Dwarven Fighter, chainmail and a small shield. And he's pretty cool guy, ready to go.
Okay, I'll go next. I am playing Jamven Silvershaper, the halfling thief, with his short sword, as befits a halfling thief, and a dagger, and even the sling with some stones. Not carrying any magic items from what it looks like, just his amazing thievable skills.
Ah.
I am playing, Thurston Rogers, the human magic user. And he has his spells, and he carries a quarterstaff, and he's using darts for distance.
Okay.
Okay. So our wonderful trio here is doing what all good adventuring parties do, seeking fame and fortune that, in particular, fortune that someone else had earned, but by golly, once they pass on to the Nether Realms, they no longer need.
That's right. Kill monsters, loot their stuff.
Exactly. And this time, our wonderful group has heard of this tomb, the tomb of this great mage, MacGuffin, that has... yes, the great magical dark mage MacGuffin's tomb that holds untold riches. And so they are off to find MacGuffin's tomb. They've got pretty good directions from a drunken gnome with loose lips, so they know where to head. They're venturing through the forest, following along this winding, twisting path that has been walked in years. And then you see a clearing, and then there it is, kind of resembling the Parthenon. It has steps going up to a larger base foundation with three columns. You can see, though, there used to be four with one just standing in a pile of rubble. The door is a nice solid iron door, and the columns themselves are actually of a long, slender female shape.
Are they holding anything up?
No, they're just very elongated female forms.
Okay. Human female?
Yes, human female.
Okay.
Any writing?
No, orc females.
Yeah. Any writing on them or anything? Or
no.
Okay.
They're just scantily clad, elongated female forms.
Huh. Do they look, like dirty, or they're clean, or?
They look relatively clean, as does the entire area, actually.
Maybe a little too clean.
Yes. Mm. And you do notice, though, as you look closer, at the foot of the steps, there are actually some human remains, some bones.
How? Really? Like completely down to the bone?
Down to the bone.
Not recent at all.
Not recent at all.
Kind of poke at it with my battle axe.
These are complete skeletons or broken up?
They're broken up.
Okay.
Okay. Because I don't think we got a cleric here, so.
No.
So much for turning undead.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So what do you guys do? It's just open clearing, the tomb straight ahead.
Hmm.
Around the sides of the tomb, I mean, is it possible to walk easily around the whole thing?
Yeah, you could walk to the entire back side of the tomb.
Yeah, okay. why don't we skirt around this thing and...
Okay.
Whichever way they're going, I'm going to move silently in the other direction.
Okay.
To sort of meet them around.
I was just thinking we should have the thief kind of do a reconnaissance around the tomb, maybe look for traps and stuff.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I think, well, at the beginning, I'm just going to move silently. Are there any – can I hide in shadows while I'm at it? Is there enough cover for me to do that as well?
Yeah, this is – yes. There's enough brush and whatnot you can hide.
So that's what the first thing I want to do is to – amongst the brush and everything I can to do my best to hide in shadows and move silently and look to see what I can find.
Okay. What'd you roll?
You want me to roll my own? Okay. Hold on a moment. Let me just
I'll just hang out at the front of the tomb then while he's searching, you know, making 29, sure.
29, I'm definitely moving. Oh, sorry. 29, I'm definitely moving silently.
Okay.
And am I hiding in shadows? 005. I am hiding in the shadows.
Yes.
Wow.
You disappear into the brush. Your fellow companions at this point don't even know where you are exactly.
What the deuce? Yes. Where'd he go?
Poof. It's like he went invisible. Perhaps he had some magical items you didn't know about.
He's right.
That
right
shadowy gem, Vin.
He's right there. I could see him plain as day. No, I'm kidding.
He's right there.
Yes. So you skirt around the perimeter of the tomb.
Okay.
And you see just some more random skeletal remains in various spots. Not a lot. You see like one or two like on the sides. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it's really clear.
Okay. So I make it all the way back to where I was. Now, on the way around, did I see any other entrances to the tomb?
No, just the main door.
Okay, so solid, just walled up.
Yep, all nice stone.
Okay.
You want to search for traps on the door then?
Not yet. Just thinking... There's no roof, right?
No.
There's no roof, but the walls are solid.
Right.
And the columns that we see are – they're not holding up a roof, but they're not – there's no – we can't see into where we're looking yet, right?
Correct.
Okay. So, I'll check for traps on the front doorway that we're on.
Okay. As soon as you step out of the clearing
– yes.
Those columns – start shrinking in size and widening and taking female forms. They're now out of their sides come steel swords and they stand in front of the door.
Oh, yikes.
I should have stayed in the shadows. I could have gotten around and tried to get a backstab in. Now it's
I know what these are, but I'll keep it to myself. You know what they are.
Okay.
All right. So they look like they're ready to attack?
They're right now just standing in front of the door looking at you.
Kind of like in a defensive posture maybe?
Yes.
Okay.
Hmm.
I brandish my battle axe and I'm standing next to the magic user ready to defend him if need.
Okay.
I am going to go to the side of the building.
Okay.
And try to climb the wall.
Okay. As you start moving towards the side of the building, one of them just starts following you, not staying next to the building, basically blocking you off from any direct path to.
So I'm not going to be able to get to the building. She's blocking my path.
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
I wonder if I could climb the statue.
Yes, climb her to climb the wall.
They're only, right now they are like 5 feet tall. They've shrunk that much.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Is she still standing on the base of the building itself?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm wondering, and so around the side, so the base of the building extends around the side?
Correct. Steps are in the front, but the actual raised foundation extends around the entire length.
Okay, it's like a dais or something like
that. Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay, so they don't seem to be inclined to attack us from where they are, and I wonder if they can even step off of it at all.
Well, I'm going to back up then and see what happens. Maybe we should back up and see what happens. Maybe
let's go back.
Yeah,
let's all take a couple steps back.
All right.
Okay, so you all back into the woods?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I back up enough to where I'm off the steps of going into this place.
Okay. As you back up the steps, they continue blocking the door.
Okay, I'll back up further into the woods, I guess.
Okay. So you're back in the woods. Then Silver Shaper, are you back in the woods now as well?
Is it possible for me to back into the woods so much that I'll be able to hide in shadows again?
Yes.
And they won't be able to keep track of me? All right, then I'm going to try that again.
Okay.
All right, hiding in shadows, here we go. I got to take a picture of this.
A 1?
All right, let me ask you, do you 000?
Oh, God.
Oh, that would be 100.
Okay, so I'm definitely not doing it. Why did I waste a roll like that? I could have used that someday.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yes, you're making a nice little hiding in some bush. At the same time, you're, like, knocking over, stepping on every twig, but you think
I'm very unhidey.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But as you all step back into the forest line,
yeah,
the female forms, they walk back to their initial position and retake the pillar shape.
Ooh, I can web them and then we can get past them.
Ooh, that's a good idea. So, like, web the columns?
Yeah.
Good idea. Give it a shot.
What do you think, Jason?
Yeah, I'm going to try to go around and climb up the back of the building, but you should try that from the front.
You should try webbing them first and then try climbing.
Yeah, yeah, try that first.
All right, so I'm going to prepare the web spell, and I'm going to put it off so I can try to – can I get all three of them in the web spell?
Let's see here. Your range for the web – area of effect.
Yeah, he's a 5th level magic user, right?
Yeah.
Let's see.
Max area, 8 cubic inches.
That's 80 cubic feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, more than enough.
Okay, so you web them?
I'm going to throw the web down so it equally pulls all three of them in there.
Okay. Okay. You throw the web out, and it just covers the entire front portion of the tomb, pillars and all.
Spider-Man.
I was just thinking that. Nice job, Spidey.
All right.
Now climb the walls like Spider-Man.
Here comes a Spider-Man.
All right. Well, yeah, as long as we've got him held, I'll just go ahead and try to climb the wall on the side as is.
Tell you what, while you're going to go up and try to climb up the side, I'm going to move up at least to the base of the steps with my weapons at ready, just in case if they somehow break through the web or they're going to move to attack you.
Yeah.
Okay?
It doesn't last forever, so.
Okay. Right. You might want to get a spell ready, like a magic missile or something, in case they are ready to go.
Yo.
Okay. Here goes the climb walls.
Okay. Okay. What'd you roll?
90.
Ooh,
nice.
Fall on my butt.
Yes. Okay, as you step out of the clearing, they take their female shape again. But they try to move towards the door, but they're caught in the web.
Oh, good.
Yes. Silver Shaper, makes a break for the wall. He throws up his grappling hook and gives it a mighty tug, rocks come tumbling towards him.
Okay. They are ruins.
He managed to avoid getting crushed by granite, but could not actually get a good firm grip on the wall to climb it.
Never take my skills for granite.
Nope.
Oh.
Yes. Okay. So at this point, our wonderful female friends are actually proceeding to start hacking at the web with their swords, trying to get free.
We got to pick them off while they're in the web.
Exactly.
I have no missile weapons.
I have a dart.
I'm gonna see if I can. Can I get behind them to backstab them?
You would be going through the web.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right, then it's just time to start slinging some stones.
Yes. Okay. So
stand there and look menacingly.
Pick up stones, Nick, and throw them.
Okay.
Is there some stones around?
Yes.
Enough to do some damage, maybe?
Yeah, from the... Yeah, you could find some, like, small, like...
Pebbles
and rocks and debris from the ruins.
I want a rock so that at least going to do a D4.
Okay. Yeah, you can find... Hey, there's some nice rocks where Silver Shaper just pulled off the side of the building.
Perfect.
Perfect.
Perfect. I'll grab those.
Okay.
Thanks, Silver Shaper.
Always glad to help. Yeah, even when I don't know I'm doing it.
Okay. So they're continuing to hack away. Who wants to go first? You guys have the initiative for this instance.
Probably the guys who already had missile weapons at the ready, so.
Yeah.
Is my darts gonna really do anything to them, or is it too small?
It can hurt them.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can throw three darts in a round, can't you?
Yeah.
Is it a rate of fire three or something like that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, so I'll throw three darts at them.
Okay.
And I got, let's see, do I get any bonuses? No. So I got a 13.
13. You throw the darts, come up a little bit short, and actually get caught in your web.
Double. That's right.
Yes. Okay.
All right, what do I get? Two attacks with the sling?
Yes.
All right, so let's see. I'll roll two d20s here for each. This is a plus one, so I'll give you the adjusted. I've got a 19 and a 14.
Nice.
They will both hit.
All right, so here comes some d4s. No adjustment on the damage, but...
Nope.
I got to take a picture of this, too. It's a couple of fours.
Nice. Oh, too bad we weren't doing. Oh, that's nice.
I'm emailing you guys these photos as I take them. Not that I couldn't have just set the dice that way.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
We trust you.
Like a four. All right.
Oh, look, boom. A 20.
You throw your sling, the stones go, hit one of the females, and you actually see little chunks of rock fall off of her.
Wow.
You actually chipped her.
Nice. Interesting. How many throws am I going to get with my rocks? Just one or two?
You're just going to get one since they're not really made for throwing. And they're
okay.
Going,
yeah. Here we go. I'll throw one. 15.
15? That
yeah,
will
fifth
hit.
Fifth level fighter. And 4 points of damage.
Yay! 4 points.
Boom. And you throw it at the same one?
Yeah, I throw it at the same one.
Okay. All right. Boom. Few more flakes of rock start coming off. It hits the flesh, but then as it comes off, it turns to a rock.
Interesting.
Hmm. Yes.
How much further are they now from cutting through the web spell?
They're getting close. You could probably get one more round, and then they'll be able to move.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just going to, next round, I think I'm going to just have my battle axe at the ready.
Okay.
Yeah. At least I got one good hit on him with a rock.
Thurston, what are you doing?
I'm trying to figure out, I'm looking through the book right now, if I can use my shatter spell on one of them.
Nice. I think the way it is worded, let's see.
Yeah, that's why I was looking it up, see if it counts as rock can be shattered. Crystal, glass, ceramic, or porcelain.
What is it basing that on? Like how tough the material is, or what?
It says non-magical objects. That's all it says.
Well, they sound magical to me. I don't know if it'll work.
You can try.
Well, it's worth a shot.
Oh, they're not affected if they're above 100 gold pieces in weight equivalent. Okay. So no, they wouldn't. They'd be way heavier than that.
Yeah, it's 10 pounds, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe you can shatter their fingers.
Oh, that would be cool.
Or shatter their sword with no fingers.
Or shatter their weapons.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, can I try shattering their weapons?
Sure.
Oh, good, because weapons aren't magical, unless mm-hmm. they're magical.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense, yeah.
It made a lot of sense in my head.
Yeah. Okay. So you cast shatter. You cast it. You see the swords starting to shake. Only nothing happens.
No.
If only that giant D20 guy had more save.
Yes. Okay. So Silver Shaper, what are you doing?
You know, from here, the sling attack is probably my best bet because I've got a chance to do more damage than I would with a sword. So here goes another two sling stones. Okay. I'm slinging these at the same one that I hit before.
Okay.
All right. And I've rolled a plus two, plus one. So I've rolled a 9 and a 3.
You fling them. They pass harmlessly against the side of the tomb.
Yeah.
Okay. And now they are free. And they start making their way slowly down the steps, and they're now at the base of the tomb.
Okay. But they're still standing on the tomb's
steps.
Material.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
I say we just hang back and attack from a distance.
Yeah, if they're not coming off there.
All right, that's cool. I mean, I could continue throwing rocks at them, I suppose.
Make faces. Mock them.
Boo-boo.
Okay, so give me... So, Heinrich.
All right. Should I chuck another rock at him?
Sure.
All right. What the heck? 17.
That you throw the rock, boom, right in the head. It staggers a bit.
And 3 points of damage.
Refaces itself right at you.
What? So it didn't seem to really hurt it?
No, it staggered it back. Little rocks. But
oh, I see.
It then after it recovers and resumes its position.
I see. Okay, gotcha. Okay, cool.
Okay, Thurston?
I'm going to throw some more darts at it again.
Okay.
And 3 shots, and I miss with all 3 shots.
Yes. Yes, the darts get caught in your web. Unfortunately, they're nowhere near the web.
Yes, magic missile.
Yes.
In the darkness.
Now, yes, Silver Shaper.
Okay, here comes 2 more stones. By the way, I had 20 to begin with.
Yes.
Oh. So here comes 2 more, and I've rolled a modified 10 and 20.
The 20, boom, right in the eye.
Modified. That wasn't. Yeah. It's not natural.
Right. It still hits it right in the eye.
Okay.
Okay.
The other one gets caught next to Thurston's dagger or darts in the web.
Okay.
Behind them.
Interesting. Okay. You're not asking me for a damage roll.
What did you roll for damage?
Does it matter?
Yes. Yes, it does, actually.
Okay. 3.
3. Okay. Now they actually advance forward.
Oh, they've stepped off the dais or whatever.
Yes. Okay. So they're
all right,
now
got the battle axe at the ready.
Yeah, so they've now moved into melee range.
Okay.
Okay.
You want us to roll initiative or what?
Yeah, let's roll a real initiative now.
Okay.
How are we doing it?
We'll just do group. Okay. So just one person roll for the group.
Who wants to roll it?
Nick.
Oh, I'll roll it. 5.
Okay. They rolled a 3.
Sweet, we go first.
Yes. So first, the column that you've all been abusing goes after our nice little thief for hitting it with a sling.
Oh, okay. No.
Swinging its mighty sword
Oh, they're going first? Oh,
yeah, okay. Yeah, low first.
Lower roll.
Low initiative. Yeah, he's doing low, higher initiative.
Okay.
Low is better.
Yeah, low's better. I rolled 3.
Okay.
Yep. Yes. And he rolls a 12.
My AC is 4.
Okay, which will hit.
All right.
And does 7 points.
7 Ow. Points. All right. I am down to, 17.
Okay.
Yes. Now, the one is going after Heinrich for throwing rocks at it.
Well, hey.
Didn't appreciate that.
All right. My AC is 4 as well.
Okay. It swings. Unfortunately, you are very short, and it goes just above your head.
Oh, good. I'm going to cut her legs off then.
And then our good friend Thurston hasn't been forgotten as well. The final column remembers you tied us up in a web and hacks at you.
Okay.
Oh, that would be a 20.
Oh, fortunately,
I'm not doing crits.
Oh,
that's good.
Whoa. 8.
Oh, okay.
Oh, ouch.
So...
He could have sneezed on me and hit me. I have an AC of 8, so.
Yeah. So you take 8 points.
Where are the hit points on here? Let's see. Oh, they're at the top. Okay. I see.
Yeah.
Yikes. Ow. I'm hurt.
Right. That's why I said we're not doing crits before I rolled the damage, because that probably would have killed you.
Ah.
And now it is your guys' turn.
Okay.
Magic missile.
I guess, yeah, there you go. Spell magic missile whammo. Go for it,
okay.
Man.
Okay.
I'm just going to blast the one right in front of me with my 3 magic missiles.
Nice. 3 magic missiles. Okay, roll your damage.
All right, so 1d4 plus 1.
1, yep.
For 3 times. Okay, 1. That's 2, 4, and that's a 3. 7.
7, okay. It, boom. You notice when you blast with the magic missiles, more rocks come off, more than you've even seen with any of the slings or darts. The magic missiles seem to have a real effect on it.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Now I'm wondering if I should either help the magic user or attack the one that's on me. I don't think it really matters. I'm going to help the magic user.
Okay.
And I'll attack the one that's on him with my battle axe. Just run over there and go, roar! Just like every other dwarf. 16 to hit.
That will hit.
And a
roll
D8.
Damage.
Oh, God, I wish you could see this. I rolled an 8. So max damage.
Nice.
9 points of damage.
Oh, you give it a mighty, mighty swing. Boom! You feel the swing vibrate through your axe. And then all of a sudden, your axe head breaks.
Oh, ah! Mommy!
But, but a lot of rocks did fall off of it, so it was like both things took damage.
Oh, terrific. Now I don't have a weapon. Huh.
Use your dagger.
What dagger?
He's a dwarf. He doesn't have dagger.
Now you can throw rocks again.
You still in your hand, though, do have...
A club.
Yes, a club. The base of the axe. The axe head is what shattered.
Nice. Okay, so now I got a club.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay.
Okay.
All right, each one of these has been sort of an individual melee with one of us.
Yes.
All right. I'm going to see how fast these guys can run.
Okay.
I'm going to hightail it for the back of the building. And see if he can keep up with me.
Okay.
Or she can keep up with me.
Okie doke. What is the move of a halfling?
Probably a little bit less. I don't know.
Actually, I think its movement rate is like 6.
Okay.
That would be crazy. That slow?
Yeah.
I know I got little legs, but come
it's
on.
It's like 6 or 9.
All right. Well, let's say that I go slower than a human.
Okay.
I'll look it up in the meantime.
Okay. So you start making a break for it. Not exactly sure where in the book the movement is. But While Jason looks up the movement of a halfling, we will conduct the rest of them. We have the one battered and crumbling column that takes a swipe at this short little dwarf that would dare hit it with an axe.
Mm-hmm.
Darn right I did.
And for whatever reason, it keeps swinging at human height, and you're a dwarf, and misses.
Nah, 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 nah. Okay. I taunt it.
Yes, its friend next to it remembers, I was attacking that dwarf, and it's now attacking my friend, so it goes after the dwarf again.
Yes.
And hits.
Ow. Yowza.
3 points?
For 6.
Okay.
All right. Okay. And then the other column is making chase with our halfling.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty much neck and neck. They're keeping pace with each other.
Okay. All right. I'll stop and fight when the chance comes then.
Okay.
I wonder if we should just run away.
Well, I was going to try to, you know, if I could get far enough away, I was going to try to climb the wall and come at from the inside, but it doesn't look like that's going to be happening.
Hmm.
Next melee round, then?
Yes, next melee round.
I don't know. Should we run?
No, we're fighting these things. Well, we're far away.
I have a battle axe in my hand. I don't know how much I could do. Oh, what the heck? They're just... Okay, fine.
Okay.
Who's rolling initiative? Me again?
Yeah, or? Just you keep rolling it.
Okay. I rolled a 2 this time.
Yeah. 3. You guys first.
Oh, okay. I guess with my busted up old battle axe, I'm going to hit the other one again.
Okay.
17.
Nice. Is it a nice hit?
D6, if it like yes. A club? Or
yes, okay. D6.
6 points. Oh, my God. Plus 1 for strength damage, so 7 points on the same dude.
Okay.
I don't believe this. This is amazing.
This time you hit it with your what used to be an axe.
My makeshift club.
Your club. Yes, blast it. More rocks come flying off them. You feel it vibrate back through your hands, except this time it actually holds up in your club doesn't break.
Oh, that's good.
Sweet.
I've done 13 points of damage to this one.
Yeah.
Jeez. Eesh.
Next. Okay.
I guess that's my turn. I will do defensively cast shield on myself.
Okay.
Because I need to drop my AC down in case he attacks. Which brings me to an armor class of 2 now at this point.
Okay. And now Silver Shaper.
You know, I think I want to dive for her legs and try to take her down.
Okay.
I'm a short, stout, little stout foot here. How do you want to roll this one?
Let's see here. Oh.
Do you want to call it overbearing? Do you want to call it some kind of a skill check? What do you want to do?
Let's see here. Let's just call it let's call it overbearing.
All right.
Yeah, basically, you're making a rush for the legs and trying to ankle pick her.
Yep.
Okay.
Ankle biter.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we don't have our numbers worked out for overbearing, but we can try to do them really quickly here. Yeah. Okay, so overbearing, we've got to... Base score to hit. My strength is 10, so I got a plus 10%. And... rushing, so that's plus 15%.
Yep.
And I'm shorter, right. so that's I'd say how much shorter am I?
They are about 5 feet, so there's probably about a 2 foot difference.
Okay, so let's call it 40%.
Okay.
Okay, so that's another 20. So I'm up to plus 45.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a weight difference, so I've got, I'm going to say, maybe another 20% weight difference.
Yes.
But plus 65% chance.
Right.
Okay. Although I think they're... Oh, no. That's a negative. That's a negative because I'm lighter, so it's going to be harder for me.
Right.
All right, so now I am down to, let's call it a 25% bonus, right?
Okay.
All right, and I've rolled a 40.
40.
Okay, so that's 65. Oh. Opponent knocked to knees.
Knees. Boom. So you dive at it. Boom, you clip it, and it just stumbles down to its knees.
Nice.
Excellent. All right, well, we'll see if I can. Is that gonna give me some kind of a bonus when I try to attack next time?
Yes.
Okay. So how do you want to do it? Wait for the next round?
Yeah, we'll wait till the next round because that was your action for the segment.
Excellent. Excellent.
Okay. And then actually, they take
halflings rule.
They also take damage for the fall.
Oh. Cool.
Oh yeah. Well, 2 points of 2 points of damage plus a strength bonus, which I don't have.
Now, and it shatters into a million pieces.
Well, it's just temporary damage because it's non-lethal.
So, yeah. Oh. So, okay. You see some little dust fall off of it. Okay. And now, so that would
be their attack, I guess.
Yes. Okay. Ooh. First, you have the downed column. Is very angry at this halfling.
I wonder why.
Clip it. It's like, we're just doing our jobs. Really.
Yeah.
So it swings.
See his side of it.
Yes. But it's still off balance from being dropped to the ground and misses.
Good.
Okay. Next. The one that's been battered, bruised, chunks of it are missing at this point.
Yeah.
Swings.
Bring it on.
Dwarf. And hits.
Oh.
Or. 5.
Okay, cool. I'm still in it.
Yeah. And then.
Want a piece of me? Let's go.
Yeah. Its friend wants some as well.
Oh, okay.
Come it on. Does not Let's like go. The aggressor.
Oh, yeah.
And rolls a 20. Good thing we're not doing crits.
No!
But it's only 3.
Oh, well. Okay.
So that's that round.
Kind of hurting, but I'm still up and kicking.
Okay. One next initiative round.
Okay, yay. I'll roll her again. 3.
2.
Don't!
Yes. Our downed female column decides to stand at this point. And then takes a swing at our wonderful little halfling.
Dun, dun, dun.
And misses.
Dang, you haven't got hit
badly.
Yet, buddy.
Actually, mighty swing and actually spins in place. Had so much force behind.
I'm guessing you rolled a 1.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. And then our other two proceed to hack at our dwarven friend. Because he keeps hitting them. They don't like that.
Well, I don't
and
like them either.
Misses. Because the one really thinks you're human size. It may be drunk. Not quite sure. And then the other one.
It's probably just stoned.
Yes.
Oh. Disconnecting for that one.
But our other one, however, realizes you are a dwarf and hits you.
How much?
5.
I'm hurting.
Okay. Money. Now I'm it's your guys.
I'm below 50% of my hit points right now, guys.
Yeah, well, I think after what I'm done, you're going to be pretty much dead. But anyway.
Terrific. All right. You got to spell the lob at the one this thing?
Oh, I got something. Yeah, definitely.
Well, okay. All right. Well, you go ahead. You got the spell, so.
Is it our turn?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's our turn now.
Well, since I've been cut down to almost a fourth of my hit points, and I'm pissed at this point, I'm pulling out a big giant fireball and throwing it at these two guys.
Okay.
I'd like to be out of the blast radius of that piece.
That's why I said you might not be living after this thing.
Yes. Well, okay. So you cast fireball.
And I'm fifth level, so that's 5d6.
That's going to hurt.
Okay.
And I think they save for half, so.
Yeah.
But I'll roll the damage first.
So will I.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh, look at that. Six. One. And a four.
Okay, so 18, 19,
24.
Okay.
I thought you said three sixes.
Yeah.
Oh.
I got to save versus spell.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
Yes.
That's 24, right?
Sure wish I could do math.
Yes. This is not the math podcast. Go find it elsewhere.
Said three sixes, a four, and a one.
Yeah.
So 18, 19, 20.
Yeah, 23.
All right.
23.
Three sixes. Yeah.
24 sounds better.
Well, either way, well, what's our dwarven friend roll for his save?
Yeah, save for spells. I need a 10 or better.
Yep.
I roll a 20!
Nice. Well, fortunately, half, so 12. So
I have 12. Oh, my God, I'm down to 2 hit points.
Well, the one column
close burn up.
That's taken no damage at all takes the brunt of the fireball and crumbles into a pile of dust.
Nice. Ew.
The one next to it, however, for whatever reason, dropped to the ground and only took half damage.
Bastard.
Oh. I only have 2 hit points. Oh. You burnt off my beard.
Which, even it dropped to the ground and then crumbled to a pile of dust.
Oh. I'm saying I pummeled the bejesus out of that thing.
Yeah, I know, really.
Gotta go down.
Yes. So that leaves...
We're still not out of the woods. Jason still has one, so...
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
And we have no cleric that can heal me. Oh, my goodness.
Now we got the Silver Shaper and right. Heinrich that can go, so...
Well, right. I am basically, yeah, okay. I guess I'll help out our halfling friend on the last one.
Okay, so this segment you'll just be running over since they actually made a break for the other side.
Okay.
So you'll spend one segment trying to catch them.
Sure.
Yes. Now, Silver Shaper.
All right, since I can't really get back enough to do a missile attack, I'll use my short sword.
Okay.
And a natural 20.
That will hit.
Oh, yeah.
All right. What am I? 1d6. No bonuses.
Okay.
One.
Woo! And that always happens. You roll something like a crit or something, and you roll like the minimum damage.
Yeah. Yep.
You give it a mighty swing, a perfect killing blow, if only it was a human.
You just flecked off the part of its nose.
Yes. A little bit of dust comes trickling down from its side. And your sword vibrates viciously, but is still intact.
All right.
Okay. And now it'll be a new segment.
Okay.
Zero initiative.
Yeah. I rolled a 1.
There you go.
6. You guys are first.
All right. You got any more spells there?
Yeah. I have one first level spell. You want me to use it?
Can he use it right now?
Sure.
Is he in line of sight?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can magic missile the last one here.
Go for it.
Ooh. 4. So 9 points of damage.
9 points.
For magic missile?
Oh, sweet. Adding 1 to each of them, so 5. And 2. 12.
Okay.
So 12.
You cast magic missile at it. They all hit. It starts vibrating rapidly, and then it just collapses into a pile of dust.
Yes, my short sword really did it.
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Yes. All I got is this broken stick in my hand now.
Actually, it's a charged
and
stick.
And no beard. You burnt off my beard.
It's a charged stick, Nick.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And if we all turn to page 18 in the Fiend
Folio. Oh, the Fiend Folio.
Yes. The Caryatid columns.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Yes. They're primarily a defensive monster.
Oh, talk about it next week.
Okay.
Let people stew about it and think about it.
Yes.
As we head over to, let's do episode number 4 of The Lumpers, and we'll be back right after that.
The It's tough out there. Orcs, goblins, bad and mad mages. Things that'd eat you is give you the time of day. People that shake your head while looking for a place to put a dagger. Yeah, it's tough. So they're tougher. They're the lumpers.
Ready?
Sure, sweetie. Go ahead.
Case of spare parts, part 4. Let me see. Looking for 2 dwarves. For female dwarf, no one knows of the boy. Found a locket we think is the kid's. Got a giant attack at the warehouse. Dead giant was one of the dwarves. Okay. The rain slowed down to a drizzle by the time I got back to the constabulary. Dodging puddles, I made my way in. Bub was still at the desk, testing his eyelids for leaks. He creaked open those eyelids long enough to tell me to go in the morgue. They're seeing the body. I thanked him and walked into the side room. Moria identified the body and signed the certificate. In the meantime, I briefed Mac on what we had. He shuffled his feet, looked at the floor, and asked us for help. Being a fine, upstanding citizen, I said sure, and reminded him of our rights. He agreed, gave us a letter to the sergeant in charge of Daggerford, and even deputized us. At least it'll give Dinkus something shiny to play with on the trip, Byron muttered. Then the four of us stopped at the Bent Nail, got a booth in the back, and ordered some drinks. I pulled out the necklace and showed it to Moria. We found this on him, I said to her. She looked at it and started to tear up. I gave her a napkin. Byron brought out the necklace he found and explained that it was found at the boarding house her brother was staying at. She looked at me with those big eyes.
Aye, mother and father each have enough. 'Tis tradition in our family.
Brothers and sisters too? Byron said softly. She nodded.
Aye, we've had 'em since we were wee babies.
Okay, I said after I downed my tankard. From what we found, this involves some potent magic if they're using it on dwarves. Dinkus accepted.
I didn't understand,
Moria said. It's our curse, lass, Dinkus stated, slightly embarrassed. A clan McFood had a history of being susceptible to magic. Which means, Byron interjected, in order for someone to wield the amount of power to polymorph, your father must have been quite a powerful wizard.
I see,
she said, looking in her glass.
Then all is lost.
Nope, I said, rising. Just means we'll have to put in some overtime on this one. Dink, get our things together for a trip to Daggerford. Byron, escort our... She looked at me with those big blue eyes again, hopefully. Friend, back to where she's staying. I'll be back later today. I gotta check with the contact outside of town. We leave at sunup. As Dink, Byron, and Moria left, I walked up to the bar to settle the tab. As I called Mars over, I looked down the bar where a duck was nursing a drink. How he got up there is anyone's guess. He had a bag slung over his shoulder and was wearing a leather cap. Mars came over, wiping out a tankard. 3 silver, he drawled. I jerked my thumb down the bar. What's with the duck? I muttered. Oh, that's Charlie, he said, glancing in that direction. Not yeah, Charlie the polymage. Came up from north looking like that. Poor Charlie, he said, shaking his head. Yeah, he has the worst luck. I slapped 3 silver pieces on the bar. Hey, we're going to be gone for a few days. Syl will be in to watch the place. Try and keep an eye out upstairs, okay? Sure, sure, he spit on the bar and wiped it. Where you headed? Daggerford, checking out a mage named Carrion. At the sound of that name, Charlie the Polyduck leaped up to the bar, ran over to me, and started flapping his wings and quacking furiously. He had a wild look of panic in his eyes. All right, you've had enough, Mars said as he grabbed the panic fowl. I motioned to Mars to let him go. I looked at Charlie straight in the eyes. Okay, what's the deal here? You know something about this guy? Charlie started to wave his wings in the air and uttered a low quacking. Suddenly I heard his human voice in my head.
My friend, this spell lasts a minute. Please heed these words.
I resisted the urge to vomit and concentrated. What do you know about Carrion, I thought.
All that I can relate here, but please proceed with caution. He is no ordinary wizard. In addition to his ability as a polymorpher, he deals with things necromantic to a degree that is unhealthy, even for those failed practitioners. Is Byron traveling with you?
Yes.
Make sure he has plenty of protection from...
At that point, the rest became incoherent quacking and the spell ended. He looked at me, shrugged his shoulders, and patted my hand. He then waddled back down to where he was sitting. Mars came over.
You okay?
Yeah, I said as I got up off the stool. Better than before. I tossed a silver to him. Another round for the duck. I crossed over to Charlie and patted him on the back. Thanks, friend. You need help getting back to human, drop by after we get back, and Byron will take care of you. He gave a quack of thanks and I walked out. It was after dark when I got to Gum's place at the edge of the swamp. I circled the tumble-down shack the little goblin calls home and had a peek in the back. Something was gnawing at me. I got off my horse Ellis, hid her in some bushes, and tramped around quietly. Smokehouse, outhouse, the usual. A few things different, though. Two horses tied up and saddled. I glanced at the lake and saw something shining near the edge. I tiptoed down to see. It was a ring with a ruby inlaid with silver. Something else, too. Entrails. From what I could make out, it could have been a wyvern. One thing I couldn't figure out that was lying in the middle of this mess was a half-human skull. I grabbed it and walked back to put it in my saddlebags. As I was walking back to Ellis, I saw something else. Three pens large enough to hold a grizzly bear was set up by the smokehouse. Two were empty, but one had a familiar occupant. I carefully walked up to the owlbear and had a good long look. He was sitting crumpled in a corner, but when he saw me, he started growling and cautiously walked over. I fumbled in my pouch and took out the half-heart amulet I found at Spim's. The beast stopped, looked at me intently, and came over to me, whimpering. His eyes were fixed on it for a long moment, and then he looked up at me, almost pleading. I reached my hand in and stroked his head. He responded by caressing it. "Don't worry, Angus. We'll get you out of this mess." I put the necklace around his neck. He nodded his head in thanks and went to lie down. I turned just in time to feel the breeze with something whizzing past my head. I looked at the back porch and saw a small silhouette holding what looked like a crossbow. "Get out of here, you scurvy dogs!" "Damn it, Gum, you nearly took my head off," I shouted back. I saw the figure drop the crossbow as I walked up to the shack. "I'm sorry, I didn't know it was you, Mr. Lojack. I'm really sorry." I pushed him aside as I went into the shack. "You got a permit for that?" I asked casually. Sure. He fumbled around in his pockets and produced a greasy note signed by the local sheriff. I glanced at it and handed it back. Gum was a bit short for a goblin, but other than that, standard issue. Greenish, big ears, big nose, scraggly teeth and hair. He had on some kind of tattered trousers and a woolen shirt that looked like he slept in it. I knew him from back in Cormier where he was a stoolie. He was sweating about half his body weight and kept glancing out the window. "So how are you, Mr. Lojack? Can I get you something to drink?" he stuttered, looking for a glass. "Nah, I already ate." I sat on what passed for his bed. The place looked surprisingly clean, with a faint smell of some kind of cleaner. "So what brings you here? You still with the Purple Dragons?" "Nah, I'm doing the adventure thing with Byron and Dinkus. You remember Dinkus." At the mention of the dwarf's name, Gum turned a sickly shade of green. He gulped. Sure. "Now, knowing you're a law-abiding citizen, I'm sure you won't mind answering some nagging questions I have, right?" I leaned on the footboard and stared straight in his eyes. No, sure, I got nothing to hide." He fidgeted with his shirt. I reached over, grabbed the front of his shirt, and dragged him in front of me. He stood rigid. "For instance, any reason you tidied this place up?"
You know, I don't want to live in a pigsty."
"I see. Mind telling me where you got the cages and the owlbear?"
I keep one around. A pet, you know."
"Uh-huh." I put my arm around his shoulder. He was trying to shake his way through the floorboards by this time. "Well, when you were taking care of your new pet, did you lose something?" He shook his head violently. I pulled out the ring. "This, maybe?" The goblin's eyes got wide and he shot out of my grip. He tried to run to the back door, but I swung Lucille's scabbard around and tripped him. He landed in a green pile. I grabbed him and held him near my face. "You want to know what I think?" I said. "I think you've had visitors. I think that owlbear ate one. And I also think you need to tell me what the hell it's all about." Gum was practically white by this time.
Honestly, I don't do nothing illegal anymore. I'm just a fisherman."
"What are you using it for bait, wyverns?" I threw him down. He just lied there, gasping. "Okay, looks like I'm going to have to get Mac out here. I'll bet he has something he can charge you with." Gum scrambled to his knees and grabbed my ankles.
No, honest, nothing's happened. I just kept the credit."
He immediately slapped his hands over his mouth. I bent down and grabbed him by the neck.
"You were saying?"
Before I could get it out of him, I heard horses outside. Three riders. "Looks like you have company," I said as I squeezed a bit harder. You better keep your mouth shut. I'll be watching this. I put him down and crept outside, looking through the window. This should be interesting.
Music for this episode was by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. Voices heard in this episode were Glenn Hallstrom and Julie Hoverson. Tune in next time for another episode of The Lumpers.
Ooh, one of those electronic voting dealies.
All right, so we're back, and ending the show up with a poll of the week. We had some people in the forums actually putting out that they want us to change the poll of the week to the 10-foot pole, to name the poll that. And 90% of the people said yes, they want that, with a very small margin saying no, it was lame, isn't the Family Guy on, or something like that. So we're going to give it another week, see what people say, but so far it looks like we're going to be changing it to the 10-foot pole. Per the listeners out there.
All right.
It's a cool name.
People have spoken.
People have spoken, and that's going to... we have any last-minute news, guys, before we head off the air this week?
The peasants are revolting.
Yeah.
Oh, the Lumpers was cool, and that was a real fun creature feature, I must say.
Definitely. We'll talk about that next week with Matt. Jason's Actual Play podcast, RFI actualplay.tk, his are up. What do you want, session 4 now, Jason, or 3? Or?
Yeah, I don't know. Matt would know. We're up to something. We're up to something.
Up to no good.
Yes. Session 4.
Actually, as of my recording, the players have moved on to the second arc, story arc of mine now. They have found the book. They found the Book of Sorrows, and now they're going on to the second arc, which is the destruction of the book now. So we'll see. And there is an opening for my game. One of the players had to drop out for real-life reasons. He had actually found a job, and he can't play anymore at that time. So if you're interested in playing, rfistaff@gmail.com, give us an email, and we'll see if we can fit you into the game. And leave us a voicemail, as always, 570-865-4210. Or as Jason said, 5708.
5,708,654,210.
That even sounds worse than before.
Alrighty then.
Other than that, I'm going to say keep it original, keep it old school, and good night, everybody.
Night, everyone.
Night, everybody.
Roll for initiative.